I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Hotel Mars, episode N. I'm joined by Dr. Space himself, David Livingston, and we welcome Charles Lurio of the Lurio Report. Both these gentlemen attending an exciting development for those of us who dream of manned space again for the United States. This is the Next Generation Suborbital Researchers Conference in Palo Alto, California. David, a very good evening to you. I hope I've said that conference name correctly.
Yes, you have, and a good evening to you, John.
We welcome Charles Lurio of the Lurio Report. Charles, a very good evening to you. We need to get into some definitions for the audience because I talk about Mars and then I use this term suborbital. What is that, Charles? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Suborbital are vehicles that will go up to something above 100 kilometers or 62 miles altitude, come back down. They experience about 4 minutes of zero gravity and come back down to a landing, and all that takes about a half an hour. And there are a series of vehicles being developed by several different companies of various designs to do that. And what this conference has been about is the exploding interest in using those vehicles for scientific research.
So these are the vehicles that we can also buy tickets on. Is that right, Charles?
Exactly. And in fact, one of the big messages here was that this scientific research and also for engineering, for testing components of spacecraft, and thus for almost nothing, $100,000 a flight perhaps, or even less, may exceed the so-called space tourism uses as a market.
David, right now, is everybody happy about the suborbital plans to sell tickets to tourists? Is that all in train, David?
I believe it is, but the industry, as Dr. Lurio has been saying, has grown way beyond just the space tourism ticket sales. There are 350, 400 people here clamoring for research opportunities in suborbital space. The economic market is potentially very huge, and there are people here from lots of different countries wanting to get in on the economics of what this market offers, which is headquartered right here in the United States.
Charles,
I think we're real pleased with the evolution and the growth in the industry.
Is it a surprise to you, Charles, and to the people in suborbital that there's such a demand by enterprise to get their experiments up and to pay big dollars for it?
Well, I wouldn't exactly count it as a surprise. I was talking to one of the vehicle manufacturers 6 or 7 years ago, and he was saying, well, you know, we think this might be a big market too, but we have no way of telling. But then what really has sparked it and sparked this conference in particular is the work of Dr. Alan Stern, formerly science head at NASA, who used to work with sounding rockets and knew the advantages of having cheap ways of trying out new kinds of things, new kinds of instruments, mechanisms, taking measurements, and getting scientific value for them. And he started this conference 2 years ago, and it's doubled in size. As David said, about 350, 400 people here.
David, you've attended many of the events. What has been a highlight of the events so far? This is the conference in Palo Alto.
The high quality of scientists and their ideas is mind-boggling to me, and I was kind of blindsided by this. I've been more on the skeptical side, and I am very, very impressed. But and I've got future guests coming on from this conference talking about ultra-low frequency vibrations in earthquakes and animal and marine life behavior, monitoring this from suborbital research. I just finished an interview with Dr. Sean Casey studying the oxygen-hydrogen barrier limit off of suborbital, and a sounding rocket is $5 million in a very rough ride of 22 times the G-force, and the suborbital it's 3 times the G-force, a very smooth ride, and as Charles said, 100 grand or maybe less if they share the payload capability with someone else.
And you get the vehicle back.
and you get the vehicle back.
And you get to be on the vehicle and work with the instruments if you want.
And Yeah, and they don't have to design their instrument for a rough ride in a very high G-force, so they're saving a ton of money, and the researchers are excited.
Now, Charles, I understand you've had some high-profile people joining in. I see a headline from Palo Alto that Neil Armstrong is calling for suborbital space and for expansion of all the programs. Is that significant to take the next steps to get a big name like that?
I think it's significant. As Dr. Stern pointed out, he had canceled an overseas trip just to come here. He was involved in what was really the prototype for this, where he flew the X-15 back in the 60s. That vehicle was originally designed as a research aircraft in the lower atmosphere at high velocities, but they started to recognize that they could go to higher altitudes instead with it. And they actually used it for several experiments on some instruments that were used in things like Apollo and Gemini, and also for some astronomical observations. Well, that vehicle was retired, but this new set of vehicles now takes that promise and puts it into a more practical package.
David, this looks like we have Virgin Galactic. We've talked about that, a Spaceship Two, but X-Corps Aerospace is getting into it with a two-seat rocket plane called Lynx. This looks like they're going to need a spaceport, David, a big commercial enterprise. Is someone building it?
Well, there are spaceports all over the place. California, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Florida has a couple, Virginia, Kodiak, Alaska. There's Spaceport Sweden. There's a group in Denmark that wants one. I talked to a group who wants to launch out of Barcelona, Spain. And the list is growing, not just in the United States. Texas is planning several spaceports. So this is going to be taken care of by the market. But already there are several commercial spaceports. And Spaceport America in New Mexico is brand new, designed 100%. For the commercial market.
Charles, how does this help NASA? Because they're struggling with a damaged reputation with the disappointing projections of their possibilities.
Well, what it does is it helps spaceflight. It will help NASA if NASA is allowed to help, let's put it this way, with this, as opposed to building things that just feed pork to districts. What I wanted to say that really the ultimate thing that we'll get out of this is that when these vehicles, and the head of X-Corps was saying this, when these vehicles are flying several times a day, the Lynx alone will be able to fly four times a day. X-Corps has flown a rocket plane seven times a day to low altitudes. So it's very feasible. But when we do that, when they're doing that, they have designed in features to try to get ultimate reusability, to reduce the cost down to the very minimum. That experience is absolutely vital. Hundreds of flights, thousands of flights with rocket engines, with control jets, with all the different, with most of the things that you need to go then to an orbital, fully reusable vehicle and vastly reduce the cost of getting into orbit for men and equipment.
And Charles, I'm not going to be all up talk here. Where's the downside on this? What are your concerns at the conference now? What has to happen to make this grow?
Well, we have to see that some vehicles come out and are workable and that they get through their test programs. Now, people have to allow for the fact that there will be accidents in those test programs. There are four or five different companies building vehicles of this type. Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company in Texas, had a vehicle that blew up in a test flight. People were remarking here that they were disappointed at how much negative press that got. They were not concerned about that. That was an unmanned test flight to altitude, to over Mach 1, and several thousand feet. And they said, well, you know, that's part of the process of learning how to do this, learning how to do space flight by actually doing it. Just as the Wright brothers did it in the early days of aviation, everyone was trying something different. But I don't know whether today's public will react so badly to this that regulations will be imposed that will make it impossible to develop these systems further, if that happens to any degree.
David, what are your concerns? What are the clouds that you can see?
Potentially excessive government regulatory market and a continued decline of the United States economy, or rampant inflation, or something that really attracts, that really distracts from capital acquisition and investment, because everything is interconnected, and these industries are capital intensive in the early days, and regulations can strangle them.
And Charles, you say you have some sense of excitement at this year's conference. Do you expect that this, the word's going to get around, and even the next conference will even be bigger, go to 500 people?
I certainly hope so. The next one will be actually in about 18 months. So by then we'll see if some of these vehicles should have gone into space.
Right, right. We have
Spaceship One.
Charles Lurio. The Lurio Report is Charles's documented and award-winning report on space business. David Livingston, Dr. Space of the Space Show. I'm John Batchelor, Hotel Mars.